Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, your host. This week's episode will delve into the immigration debate that has seized Washington, D.C. and the country as a whole. At issue in particular is the fate of DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, which is set to expire on March the 5th. That issue has since been tied to greater border security, to a possible wall on our southern border, and to the family reunification policy that the president refers to as chain migration. In this hour, we'll hear from Ali Noorani. He's executive director of the National Immigration Forum, and he'll be in conversation with my new co-host, Ray Suarez, who most of our listeners know of from his time at PBS NewsHour and NPR's Talk of the Nation. This will be Ray's maiden interview on World Affairs and our opportunity to welcome him to this new role. This broadcast is made possible by the generous support of Chevron and the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation. And now to Ray and Ali Noorani.
Let's start with the lay of the land. As the United States and its Congress approaches the March 5th deadline for the expiration of deferred action, Where's the action? What are the proposals in play? How are they looking right now?
Well, maybe I'll just take a quick step back to bring everybody up to speed here. So September of last year, President Trump rescinded the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, and he gave Congress a deadline of March 5th of this year to achieve a legislative solution that would protect approximately 700,000 young people who had received protection from deportation and work authorization. Since September of last year, we've seen about 17,000 individuals lose their protection because, you know, the president ended the program and they were not able to renew. Now, there have been some court cases that have, you know, muddied that water a little bit, but still, the program has been ended and we're looking at this March 5th deadline. Over the last few weeks, we have seen a range of senators and members of the House put together proposals from the Democratic side, from the Republican side, and even bipartisan proposals. What we're all looking at here is a March 5th deadline where I think President Trump has a real opportunity to make history and do something that neither Bush nor Obama could achieve in terms of fixing some part of our immigration system, or through his authority, in essence, sign off on the detention and deportation of nearly 700,000 young people who have received protection under the DACA program.
Haven't the signals from the president himself made it seem like he's going to do the latter rather than the former?
I think the president is on the cusp, unfortunately, of snatching defeat from the jaws of victory. I think that his, or perhaps it's his staff, deeply partisan approach to the issue, so that what he would like to see is significant, if, you know, 30% to 50% decreases in legal immigration. You know, in essence, using Dreamers as a negotiating chip in a much broader and bigger game. I think at the end of the day is going to tarnish, and like I said, it's going to lead Trump to snatch a defeat from the jaws of victory.
Well, you call it partisan, but if you're looking at it in a cold-blooded and tactical manner, he has kind of painted the Democrats into a corner, hasn't he?
Well, I think that both sides are responsible here, and both sides really have the opportunity to come together. I think that, you know, Trump, you know, he's played his cards, for better or for worse. He said that, I want a 40% cut in legal immigration, I want $25 billion for a wall, and I want to end the diversity visa program. Oh, and by the way, I'll extend a path to citizenship for 1.8 million Dreamers. So he's put his cards on the table. But you've also seen Republican and Democratic senators come together on really sound proposals that Trump has said, you know what, I don't want that. But Trump can't get to 60 or 218 with his demands. The only way he can get to 60 in the Senate and 218 in the House is through a bipartisan compromise. And, you know, at the end of the day, the American public, they're not going to look at Senator Schumer and say, well, you were too bipartisan. They're going to look at Donald Trump and say, your deep partisanship here has led to the deportation of people that we've come to know and love.
Aha, people we've come to know and love. Have the so-called Dreamers, by their very high public posture, by their willingness to either, depending on your opinion, either bravely or foolhardily make themselves known, make themselves public, make themselves visible, created a bit of a challenge for both sides, because we know these young people. We know who they are. We know where they are. But the numbers that are affected by the president's proposal are much larger in the other parts of his overall immigration package, aren't they?
Well, I don't necessarily agree. I think what the administration has said is we want to look at this population of dreamers that I think it's not about me. I think that the American public has come to understand what their contributions are to the country from a cultural perspective, from a security perspective, from an economic perspective. And what the Trump administration has done is said, okay, you'd like to address the contributions of 1.8 million people who are here right now. As a result, what I would like as the Trump administration is 1.8 million people fewer coming in the future. And what he's done is he's looked at ways to decrease family immigration and the diversity visa lottery, and in essence, use the Dreamers as negotiating pawns to decrease legal immigration. So, this is a numbers game, but the number is that the Trump administration is really focused on is the future of the nation when it comes to legal immigration.
Well, you're the executive director of the National Immigration Forum. As the forum looks at these various proposals, are we at a moment in the life of the country where it's really hard to tease them apart, calmly look them over, and say to America, here's where we come down on this? Because sometimes the debate is economic, sometimes it's political, sometimes it's legal, and sometimes it's moral and emotional and cultural. And it makes this one of the hardest things to talk about in American life.
I think that 99% of this debate is cultural and emotional. In fact, I think that's really the primary question that drives this conversation. And I think for a lot of Americans, they ask, are immigrants integrating or isolating? And then they're led to ask, are immigrants threats or protectors? Are they givers or takers? Well, at the National Immigration Forum, working with conservative and moderate faith, law enforcement, and business leaders across the country, we believe that immigrants are protecting our nation as members of the armed services, are giving to our nation as jobs creators, and ultimately becoming Americans. So I think that, while Trump, again, he's put his cards on the table, in order to have a thoughtful, rational debate, that's where the role of Leader McConnell in the Senate and Speaker Ryan in the House becomes so crucial. Are they going to, in essence, marginalize their right wing in order to provide space for their more moderate members of the Republican Party who are in the Senate and the House to actually reach a bipartisan compromise?
I'm interested in your conclusion that this is mostly moral and emotional. There are studies released, position papers, speeches from the leaders of the National Chamber of Commerce, various regional chambers of commerce. There are discussions of ways to change the way we count in the census, the decennial census, in order to apportion members of the House of Representatives across the country. There's the old saw, what part of illegal don't you understand? There is a dimension to this, and a very, very strong appeal to African Americans, incidentally, that permissive immigration has watered down their wages and put them in competition with people from other parts of the world over the last two generations. This does have more dimensions than just a moral and cultural argument, doesn't it?
Well, that's why I say that there are three questions that the public grapples with here: cultural, security, and economic. And in every moment of this debate, I think those questions play out in a different way. And the way that I think we've come to see this as, again, based on the work that we've done, the research that we've done, and we really try to get beyond the white papers, beyond the political polling, and have really tried to understand, what are the tensions that are playing out in the Southeast, where you're seeing a massive increase in the Latino population. And you have a African-American and a white population that's been there for generations, and they're feeling this tension. Well, in our work in these communities across the country, we've come to understand this tension better. And people want to be a part of a nation of laws. We want to have a secure border. We want to have control of who's coming into the U.S. And that is absolutely legitimate. But people also want to live in a nation of grace, where we are treating each other with compassion, where we understand why that Syrian refugee family is fleeing and why they see America as a beacon of hope, why the undocumented immigrant farm worker is putting food on our tables. So, how do we navigate that tension between being a nation of laws and a nation of grace? I think ultimately, I would love to say it comes down to our elected leadership. It doesn't at this point. I think it really comes down to our civic leadership. And that's why I think the role of the pastor, the police chief, the business owner at that local level in terms of having that conversation and being able to move the ball forward, makes the policy change a lot easier, I should say.
I'm wondering whether this is a particularly difficult time. You've been working in this area for some years. Whether this is a particularly difficult time to have this conversation because there's so much misinformation out there about how people got here, who's coming, from where, the circumstances under which they stay. Every time the president says to a cheering crowd, people are pouring over the border. The border is not secure. It's got holes. It's like Swiss cheese. We don't even have a border. Isn't he making your job that much more difficult?
Ray, it's a good question, but it's also a question I'm probably going to give you a surprising answer on, in that this is hands down the most exciting time to be working on immigration. I think for the first time, you're seeing an intense level of interest in this issue across the political spectrum. When you have, earlier this week, for example, some of the country's leading evangelical women, Anne Voskamp, Beth Moore, and these are women who speak to millions of evangelical women across the country who they read Matthew 25 on a small digital video. And we've already seen hundreds of thousands of views of that video where they're speaking with a moral voice about compassion. We're seeing law enforcement officials speaking to what does it mean to be a nation of laws. So yes, there's a lot of information out there. Some of it's good, some of it's not so good. But I'm terribly excited about the future for the country because I think for the first time, we are grappling with this question in a really honest way. Now it's upon all of us to ensure that we are, sticking to the facts and engaging each other in a respectful way. Regardless of what happens with the legislation, I think this debate is going to continue to happen in an increasingly constructive way because immigrants are a bigger part of our lives than ever before.
When I put it to people who are adamant about what the state of play is and their view of the state of play, they simply tell me I'm lying or I don't have all the facts at my hand when I suggest that we're spending more money at the border and putting more people to work securing the border than we have in earlier years, that fewer people are successfully making it across, that there are fewer undocumented people in the country than there were during the George W. Bush administration. These are facts put in evidence by the Department of Homeland Security, by ICE, but I'm dismissed as a liar, and it really makes it hard to get to some common wisdom on this and how to move forward.
I can't argue with you that there is a low level of trust in certain messengers, and some people will trust what you say, top to bottom. Others won't, and I have the same issue, right? So for the question is that who is the right messenger to communities? Who is for that person who is not going to believe what I say? Who will they believe? Will they, who from conservative media, who from, the social conservative world, will they believe in terms of explaining this issue in, a language and a set of values that resonate with different parts of the American public? That is the situation that we're in. I don't think it's an insurmountable challenge. I think that as those, for those of us who care deeply about this issue, it's on us to actually also get out of our bubbles and make sure that we are engaging other, you know, leaders in other communities who, you know, agree with us on this issue, but, you know, we haven't quite sat down with them and say, okay, let's work together.
I've been reading your book, There Goes the Neighborhood, How Communities Overcome Prejudice and Meet the Challenge of American Immigration. I've been looking at the National Immigration Forum website at various announcements and position papers. I get where you are at and where the group is at, but at some point, do you have to take what you can get rather than what you want? At the end of this process, given where everything is now, as we head toward March 5th and the expiration of deferred action, will you and people who agree with you in this area have to accept an America that takes fewer people from the rest of the world? Is that just in the cards?
You know, we are, as an organization, are prepared to make tough decisions. I don't want to make a decision today that hurts the country in the future or undermines our long-term goals in terms of really advancing a immigration system that serves the needs of the American worker. At the end of the, you know, but when we get to March 5th, we may have to, you know, look at changes to, you know, the border enforcement system. We have to look at changes to other part of the system. But the question is, you know, can members of the House and the Senate create packages that can get us to 218 and to 60? If we can get to that place and we have to make some tough decisions, let's do that. But we've got a lot of work to do between now and that point. And, you know, we are working with allies across the country to make sure that Dreamers are protected, our border is secure, and that we're, you know, moving ahead with other fixes in the future to the immigration system.
There is a no caucus in the House of Representatives on the president's, in the president's party, that will oppose almost anything that countenances long-term, large numbers of arrivals. So they're not going to be part of that 218. In the Senate, you've got a Republican Party with barely half the chamber, and it's got to get to 60. Are Democrats underplaying their hand? Do they have strength in their resistance? They say, look, you've got to, you need us to get to 60, so we have some power in this negotiation.
And that's the beauty of this March 5th deadline. I think the closer we get to March 5th, the more that President Trump, Speaker Ryan, Leader McConnell will realize that they will be the ones responsible for cutting this deal. And they can make a historic deal that protects Dreamers and our border, or they can make a deal that, in essence, signs off on their deportation. It's going to be in their hands. And I think the closer we get to March 5th, the more pressure there will be on the administration in particular to achieve a solution that gets us to that bipartisan compromise. Because there is no other way that we can get to, that President Trump can claim victory without the help of Democrats. So yes, you know, they do have leverage. And I think that leverage increases the closer we get to the 5th.
In your book, in your public appearances around the country, you talk a lot about how different this issue looks from the top down versus from the bottom up. Given what Pew and Gallup and many other public opinion researchers have had to say in recent years about this issue, that sizable majorities of Americans favor a deal on DACA and the DACA-eligible young people, don't want to end family reunification law. How come we have the politics that we have? How come we have the gridlock that we have between two major parties, if, for their part, the American people have kind of made up their minds on this thing?
Well, this is the unfortunate consequence of gerrymandering, where, you know, a number, you know, most, I would argue, of your House Republicans are, you know, their election really takes place in the primary. And that means that in most cases, you know, if it's a hardliner who is the incumbent, they have no incentive to move to the center. Somebody who's more of a moderate Republican, you know, they're always afraid of an attack from their right flank. And that's, I think, then leads to this stalemate where, you know, Congress is increasingly out of step with public opinion on this question. Because, you know, even in places like, you know, Georgia, the Carolinas, the panhandle of Florida, where districts may or may not be very diverse, even among, even within districts that are majority white, you see a large, you know, significant support for the DREAM Act, for immigration reform. But that support will dissipate or will not be intense enough, if you will, to kind of carry a primary election. And that's, you know, at the end of the day, we've got to figure out how to bridge that gap so that the Republican voter sees this as a as an issue of intensity, so that they're expressing their opinion not just in a phone call or in a polling question, but also the ballot box.
Has the president's categorical statements, both as a candidate and as president of the United States, given him less room for movement? Because he said, these things are my bottom lines, they aren't negotiable, they have to happen, and I won't approve any deal without them. Has he limited his own freedom of movement?
You know, so the president comes into office as, you know, the best deal maker ever. And he's actually doing a pretty bad job of finding a deal in this case. And I think he's been poorly served by his attorney general, by Stephen Miller, the head of domestic policy, and unfortunately, even by his chief of staff, all three of whom have emerged as leading immigration hardliners who, frankly, would rather see the status quo or just an increase in enforcement. As a result, they have boxed the president in to a position where, like you said, he has no wiggle room. And without that wiggle room, he's going to be losing leverage as we get closer and closer to March 5th, because if there's one thing this president cares about, it's good press. And the press is going to start to increase, and you'll see an increase in stories of DACA recipients losing their status. After March 5th, DACA recipients who've lost their status being put into deportation proceedings. And it's nobody else other than the president and his Department of Homeland Security that is doing that. And, you know, it's going to be his inability to reach a deal with Democrats that I think is really going to tarnish his legacy when it comes to immigration.
Is the timing of this not your friend? And here's what I mean. During much of 2017, during the president's first months in office, there was a lot of speculation about an open breach between the Oval Office and the president's own party in the House and the Senate. But then, as we got closer to a deal and a new tax law, the speculation abruptly shifted and talked about Trump's Republican Party, about there being very little daylight between the president and the leadership in the House and the Senate. Given that this is coming up now, during one of those moments where we're talking about them being very much in sync, does that give you and the National Immigration Forum room, place for concern?
It does, and it does, because I think that the you know, more to the further to the right the Republican Party is led by the president, the harder it is to reach a compromise, because, like, you know, like we discussed, there's that the lack of the wiggle room. But then let's look ahead, you know, 8-9 months to the midterm elections. You know, their gamble is that, you know, competitive Senate races, competitive House races are going to be driven by this issue. Well, when you look at the data, there's actually a very, I want to say, 60 House districts that are going to be competitive, but they are currently held by Republicans in fairly diverse and economically well-off communities, which means that those are communities that are very most likely to be in support of a rational solution when it comes to Dreamers. So the president may actually be playing bad electoral politics in this case, too, because he's leading Republican members of the House down a path and away from a constituency whose vote they're going to really need come November. And, you know, a number of them, their kid's best friend could very well be a DACA recipient. And that's a really, really powerful story at the dinner table when that question comes up of, who are you going to vote for?
I want to broaden out the conversation away from the politics of the moment to the politics of the next 30 years. People have been watching the Trump administration closely, and some have concluded that what the president's doing is not just responding to current anxieties, but trying to bend the curve of American demography so that where we end up in 2044, where the Census Bureau had originally predicted the United States becomes a minority-majority nation, is actually postponed or may never get here, by ending family reunification, by cutting down on the number of people who come in every year, by ending the lottery, which brings in new arrivals from underrepresented countries in the American immigration flow, by sending home the DACA recipients, that all this adds up to a response to white anxiety about a country where they will not be the unquestioned majority any longer. I'm sure you've heard about that speculation. I'm sure you've read about it. What do you make of it?
Well, and you know, for my book, There Goes the Neighborhood, I interviewed about 60 people across the country. And one of the first people I interviewed was Dick Longworth. He was he's a retired fellow out of the Chicago Council for Global Affairs. And for years, he was a journalist in the Midwest. And his book, Caught in the Middle, story about the Midwest and the age of globalization, was really, for me, at least, something that really inspired me, not just to write the book, but to really help the National Immigration Reform embark on the strategy. But what Dick tells me in the interview, to paraphrase, is that it doesn't matter how high a wall that Donald Trump wants, it will never be high enough to get in the way of hormones, which is kind of a glib way of saying, you know, we can try to keep people out, we can try to remove people, we're going to become a more diverse nation just as a result of the folks who are already here. So that's one thing. You know, cultural demographic change is happening. I'm not going to say it's destiny, but it's happening. And you can't stem that tide. You can only stem that tide so much. But then there's an economic question here, where the American Action Forum in 2015 did a study. And the American Action Forum is a very, you know, it's a center-right think tank here in D.C. But in 2015, they found that by 2020, you know, the end of Trump's first term, our economy is going to be facing a private sector worker shortage of 7.5 million people. So what the Trump administration may want to do in terms of delaying the diversification of the American population, number one, may not be possible just because of who's already here. But number two, it actually undermines our economic competitiveness, potentially for generations. You know, I think the last thing we want to do is be facing the problem that, you know, many European countries, Japan, are facing, where they have a shrinking population. That's a slippery slope to be going down, and it would be really, really hard to turn around.
You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. We're hearing from Ali Noorani. He's the executive director of the National Immigration Forum, and he's in conversation with my co-host, Ray Suarez.
The younger you are in the United States, the more likely you are to be a member of a racial or ethnic minority, right?
Absolutely. Pew Research has found that nearly half of U.S.-born Latinos are younger than the age of 18, which means that, you know, that's the fastest, number one, that's the fastest growing segment of the population in the country, the Latino community. If half of them are under the age of 18, you know, that's where we're going to see the growth, whether it's in, you know, our colleges, our workforce, much less as the country ages over time. So, you know, again, I think that the efforts, if this is ultimately an effort to, you know, undiversify the country by the administration, it's a losing battle.
But is there underlying anxiety that has to be talked about, that has to be addressed, that the concerns of members of the majority culture and majority race in this country need to be in on a conversation where, they're reassured?
Absolutely. I think across the country, we've seen that, you know, as communities are changing, there are points of tension, there are frustrations. And what it comes down to is, you know, is the civic leadership in a town in Midwest America, are they in a position to be able to help that community change? So, for example, Storm Lake, Iowa, you know, over the years has seen a dramatic increase in the percentage of Latinos in Storm Lake, Iowa. That's a small town. I drove through it last summer. We've done a lot of work with the law enforcement community there, as well as the faith community. And what we found is that it is the business leadership, it's law enforcement, it's the faith community that really helps a place like Storm Lake, Iowa change with the times, because on one hand, you know, Storm Lake, Iowa doesn't survive without Latinos working at the Tyson's factory there, contributing to the tax base. On the other hand, there is tension and frustration. So, you know, how do you navigate that? And, you know, I think every community, every town has a different way of doing that and a different story.
That idea that America is going to be a different place 20 years from now is one that seemed to be a prospect that was going to go easily and smoothly. I think we were lulled as a country into an idea that this would be a transformation that we were very, very capable of making during the first Obama term, where this idea of a multicultural America seemed to be going down well. There was almost a triumphalist greeting of that moment, even among people who didn't vote for the president, that America had sort of shaken off some of its difficult history, and we could look forward to something different. Isn't it going to be a much more complicated march to that date, whatever date it is, where we do cross that invisible threshold?
Well, that's why, Ray, I really believe strongly that, you know, demographics is not destiny. And, you know, a lot of my friends to the left will say, well, you know, eventually we'll just get enough people of color and this won't be a problem. Well, no, that's not true. Because if we don't create the conversations, create the understanding that get us between, you know, 2018 and 2050, we as a country are just going to continue to be torn apart by, you know, whether it's the politicians of today or the politicians of tomorrow, let's be honest. So I think that we have to be honest with ourselves and with each other about these changes. And I think we also, you know, when it comes to the immigrant community and how immigrants are engaging here, I think we have to realize that and be honest that, you know, immigrants who are coming to the U.S., refugees who are coming to the U.S., they're going to change. You know, they're going to learn English. They're going to pick up different customs and traditions. But the communities that are receiving them, they're going to change as well. And I think that the, you know, civic leadership is saying, well, we're going to always be able to keep things the way they were. You know, it's dishonest, and it makes everything a lot harder.
You've lived this story, though. You're the child of immigrants. You grew up in a part of the country where there weren't a lot of South Asians when you were growing up. What did you see? What did you learn along the way that got you ready for this moment?
So I grew up in Salinas, California. My parents came from Pakistan, and, you know, in Salinas in late 70s, early in the 80s, was a city of, you know, a large town, small city, you know, 50, 60,000 people. And the way I put it is that, you know, the majority of my friends were either children of, you know, farm workers or children of farm owners. And the South Asian community that I grew up with was by and large, you know, my two sisters, my parents, and myself. So what I learned early on in life, whether or not I realized it at that time, was the importance of being able to work across communities and cultures, being able to be friends with everybody, be able to listen. And those experiences, I think, have really shaped who I am today in terms of really wanting to work with staff, working with partners across the country to get out of our comfort zones, to, you know, sit down and have those conversations and begin to understand, okay, how do we make a different case to the public of, you know, what does diversity mean? What does inclusivity mean? What does immigration mean? And a lot of those experiences, a lot of what I do today is based, frankly, on the experiences growing up and most importantly, the values that my parents taught me.
You started out with education and training in public health and access to health care. How did you make the transition to immigration advocacy?
So I was in Boston running the public health programs for two large health centers, the Dorchester House and the Common Square Health Center. And it was there when I, number one, realized that what was the impact of the nation's broken immigration system when we were working with some Vietnamese youth whose families had come in as refugees. And, you know, their kids growing up in this big city, right? They make a dumb mistake. They get into a fight. Their public defender told them to plead guilty and, you know, take the community service, you know, like so many have done. But it turns out by that guilty plea, this child who came as a refugee was now deportable. And, you know, for me, I remember that meeting very, very clearly that it was a shock to the families and that their child, who did not know Vietnam, You know, they knew Fields Corner of Boston, Massachusetts, was suddenly going to be put on a plane and sent back. And I just realized that at that point, there was, you know, this bigger problem that was facing these communities. And, you know, I was fortunate enough to be able to then, you know, take on the leadership role of the Statewide Immigrant Rights Coalition in Massachusetts, the Massachusetts Immigrant and Refugee Advocacy Coalition, and really begin to build out these coalitions and begin to understand, okay, how do we have this conversation, whether it's in, you know, Springfield, Massachusetts, or Salinas, California.
Until a fairly recent period of very rapid change, the American South, the states of the old Confederacy, were the most uniformly native-born parts of the country, with the exception of Florida and Louisiana, which were open to the world for a long time. There were very few immigrants in places like Arkansas, Alabama, Mississippi. They didn't have an Ellis Island moment. They were not Boston, New York, Baltimore, Angel Island off of San Francisco. How are they experiencing this era of American immigration in a way that's different from the places like Los Angeles and New York, which have been taking in people from all over the world for a really long time?
Well, it's interesting because it's happened both in a gradual way in terms of, you know, in the Southeast has you've seen the diversification of the agricultural sector. But then in the last 10 years, that gradual change accelerated dramatically. So now you see, when you look at the data nationally, the fastest growth in the foreign-born population is taking place in the Southeast, not in the West Coast or the Southwest or the Northeast. It's in the Carolinas and Georgia. It's driven by, you know, business, you know, the large agricultural or manufacturing presence or meatpacking presence in those parts of the country. But it's also driven by, you know, cultural changes in those communities. So for the book, I interviewed a pastor in Greenville, South Carolina. Victor was his first name. And Victor Ayala, I believe. And he told me a story of coming to Greenville to teach at a seminary, at a Southern Baptist seminary in South Carolina. Not for, you know, the work in terms of, you know, working on a farm or in a meatpacking plant, but he realized that, you know, he saw how South Carolina was diversifying. And, you know, in essence, as the textile mills went to Mexico, Mexico seemed to come to South Carolina. And I remember him telling me that, you know, he was working with Hispanic churches in the area because they were growing so quickly to find space. And he tells me a story of one of the large white megachurches was kind enough to provide a Hispanic ministry some space for their Sunday service. The problem was that the church was so big that they often depended on the local police to manage traffic. And unfortunately, they saw many Hispanic congregants turn around and not go to church because they were afraid of the police. So what was happening in South Carolina is, number one, it was diversifying. Number two, that diversity and that growth was being seen not only in the economy, but also in the cultural and religious space. But then number three, there was this tension with local police because people were afraid of going to church because they thought local police would turn them over to immigration enforcement. That story plays out over and over again.
Because this is not a part of the country marked by megacities, it's not like Sinclair's The Jungle with teeming immigrant neighborhoods or the New York of Jacob Riis. Does it happen in a different way when we're talking about a far-flung, suburban, small-town, mid-size and small-city states like Arkansas, where people who've come to work in the chicken and pork industry have really changed the place?
Absolutely. So, you know, I've spent some time in Arkansas, you know, both in Bentonville, where Walmart is based, but also south of Bentonville, where Tyson's is based. You know, so in the Walmart community, you see a diversification of that, by and large, suburban community, but based on, you know, kind of back office functions. So a lot of engineers, you know, some service sector, but it's really a diversification based on a skill set that is driving the economy through technology. You go, you know, about an hour outside of Bentonville, and you see how that community is changing. And neither of these are, you know, large urban areas where, you know, you're able to, you know, number one, have a sense of community or a sense of public transportation that gets people from point A to point B. I mean, these are vast expanses of land that diffuse people and require people to you know, be in a car to get to a job that, you know, where their skills are needed. But it also really dramatically changes and it changes the makeup of that strip mall in Arkansas, where in the past it was, you know, one type of food. Now it's, you know, food from around the world.
Do you have to do battle as you do your work against very deep-seated myths, ideas about immigration that simply aren't true, but they're widely held, passionately believed, and form some of the emotional underpinning of the conclusions that people make about these laws?
Yes, but, you know, I try not to approach it as doing battle, because I think that that's the wrong way to approach it, and I think it assumes that somebody's wrong. You know, so for example, at this moment in time, I don't think people really understand, you know, what it takes to become a citizen, what it takes to enter the country, quote, the right way. So a lot of what we try to do is provide the information, the facts, but also through a message and a messenger that they trust, so that, you know, we're not going to dismiss somebody's understanding or misunderstanding of the immigration system or what it takes to become a U.S. citizen. I think if we dismiss their belief, we've lost any ability to change their belief. So, you know, the way we put it is that we want to meet people where they are, but we just don't want to leave them there.
Yet, those myths must make your job harder, must make trying to get a clear picture of what the country needs, what's best for individual human beings, what's humane, what's moral, to get through the thicket of a very fondly held belief has to make your job easier. I understand your point about not thinking of it as doing battle, not trying to define people as wrong, but they are wrong, aren't they?
Yeah. On the other hand, I look at it this way, is that, you know, right now there are more and more opportunities to get information in front of people's eyeballs and to provide them the information and even the experience through which they can change their opinion. So there's a project called the Global Immersion Project based out of Oregon, and they work with the faith community and take faith leaders to the U.S.-Mexico border. And we've done a number of these trips with them where, you know, the idea is to, you know, engage a pastor who is really struggling with this issue, and he or she knows that they, you know, they need more information in order to work with their congregations to reach a more informed place. So what we've tried to do is, working with the Global Immersion Project, put together delegations of pastors from across the country, from conservative parts of the country, and ensure that they have an experience on the border. They're talking to Border Patrol. They are talking to migrants. They're talking to people who've been there for generations. So then they can go back to their congregations, their communities, and say, this is what I saw. These are the facts. And that's hard work. That's slow work. But, you know, whether it's that direct experience or sharing with somebody, you know, that 1 minute video of that story from the border, I think there are more and more opportunities to change people's minds and, you know, to break through that stalemate.
Let's return to the politics and the road ahead over the next couple of weeks. What has to happen? What is, let's sketch out some possible scenarios, some likely scenarios, some desirable scenarios. What will you be looking for as markers of how this is all going to end up?
Well, I think there are two things that I think are going to happen this year in 2018. One is we're going to reach some sort of resolution when it comes to DACA recipients. You know, ideally, we'd like to see something that protects a large number of Dreamers that's wedded to smart border security. That may, hopefully, will happen by March 5th. That may happen soon thereafter if we can, you know, continue to build pressure on the administration. So I'm confident that we will get to a solution there. And I think that it's important that everybody's weighing in with their members of Congress to really push them to get to a constructive solution. The second thing, we haven't talked about this, is that I think we're going to see efforts by the administration to incite voters to the poll around the concept of a sanctuary city. And it's a concept that is, in my opinion, politicized by both the left and the right. And at the end of the day, it really undermines the ability of local law enforcement to do their job. And I think the administration is going to use legislative and ballot initiative campaigns against, quote, sanctuary cities, much like, you know, Republicans did in the 2000s, used gay marriage to incite people to the polls. And I think that we've got to be ready to, you know, have a conversation about safety and security in a way that doesn't marginalize the immigrant community, but also doesn't marginalize folks who are rattled by the idea of sanctuary.
And both left and right have misstated what a sanctuary city is.
Absolutely. And there are a few things here. Well, number one, there is no legal definition of what a sanctuary city is. The issue is Immigration and Customs Enforcement will put forward a detainer for somebody who is undocumented, has been arrested for, you know, let's just say driving without a taillight or driving without a license. That detainer is not a criminal warrant. So law enforcement, they have, under current law, under current case law, they can hold that individual for up to 48 hours. After 48 hours, there have been multiple court cases that have said local law enforcement is breaking the law if they hold somebody beyond 48 hours. Department of Justice AG Sessions has said that if you don't hold somebody on a detainer past 48 hours, you're a sanctuary city. So it's politicized in a really awful way by the Department of Justice, and it puts local law enforcement in a tough place. The way that we put this is that, you know, I don't want to live in a sanctuary city. I want to live in a safe city. And a safe city is a city where every cop on the corner can fulfill their oath to serve and protect everybody in their community. And the only way they can do that is if they're trusted by everybody in their community. So, you know, earlier, you know, a few days back, there was a story out of Eastern Washington where an individual called the local police to report a trespasser. The local police didn't do anything about the trespasser, but they took the person who reported the potential crime, asked him for his papers, and turned him over to ICE. Now his three young children are left without a father. I'm going to bet you pretty good money that any immigrant in that community is going to think twice before calling local police to report a crime. As a result, everybody's much less safe.
Examples like that, cases like that, are thought to be something that, let's say, benefits one side or another in the endless back and forth over these things. How do you see it playing out? When people turn on their late local news somewhere in the Midwest, somewhere in the Great Lakes, and they see a high school math teacher, a local businessman, a mother of a couple of minor but citizen children being sent back in a way that doesn't really fall into a pattern given the actions of the Trump administration since it came to Washington, but one that does get a lot of attention, what's the effect in individual households?
You know, I think that the context within which we're operating is very different for, obviously, for a number of reasons. But one of the differences now is that immigrants are parts of communities across the country that, you know, we've never seen. So what I mean is that more and more Americans who've been here for generations are having an experience and getting to know somebody who's an immigrant. So as a result, they've come to love the Maria or the Muhammad that they know, but they remain afraid of the Maria or the Muhammad they don't know. Whether that Maria Muhammad is, you know, a neighborhood over, a town over, a state over. So I think these stories that we keep, you know, we keep seeing pop up and local news across the country, and even national news, begins to help people bridge that gap between the Maria and the Muhammad that they know and love and the Maria and the Muhammad that they don't know. But through the news, they're seeing, you know, being detained for unjust reasons, being targeted, being profiled, et cetera. So we're slowly starting to bridge that gap, and I think that these stories are very helpful in that way.
It is a surprise when I talk to people who are active on both ends of the great tug of war over this issue. They are surprised to find out that the average length of stay in this country for people who are living without documents in the United States is 12.7 years. That is a stunning statistic because we've been taught over time to think of it as border jumpers, as visa overstayers, pretty recent arrivals in the United States. But there are hundreds of thousands of people who've been here a really long time and now have a life.
And they have more than a life. They've got a family here. I mean, their own houses here. They are deep-seated parts of American society. And for an administration to be looking to ramp up enforcement and, you know, case by case, one by one, remove people who have been here 10, 12 years, if not longer, it's not just the impact on that family, which is dramatic, but the impact that on the community that surrounds the family, which will be dramatic. And that's why I think that the closer we get to March 5th, the more the American public is going to realize that, you know what, there's no one here responsible other than President Trump for the detention and deportation of the dream of, you know, DACA recipients. And that's why I think that the closer we get to that date, we're going to see an increased amount of energy from the administration to reach a bipartisan deal.
Does it lance the boil? Does it take some of the emotion, some of the anxiety out of it to just talk about social utility, to talk about what ends up being best for a town or a school district or a street, to be a little bit more judicious about what we do and how we do it?
I mean, I think ultimately as immigration advocates, we've got to do a much better job of making the case why immigrants and immigration are good for the American worker and their family. So it's not even the street. It's not even the town. It's really the individual American and their family. Because, you know, as we've talked about, it's that individual and their family, they're the ones who are grappling with these changes. And, you know, some days they, you know, people wake up and say, you know what, I'm good with these changes and we're going to figure this out. Other days they wake up and say, you know what, I'm kind of scared and I'm worried and I want some more enforcement. And people, I think, always live between those two poles. And, you know, the way I put it is, you know, one pole pulls you to be a part of a nation of grace and the other to be a nation of laws. And how do we help each other live on that, in that tension?
Do you find yourself having to explain that, for instance, both legal and undocumented immigrants in this country are, on average, more law-abiding and less likely to be offenders than native-born Americans?
Absolutely. So this is kind of where sometimes the
because this is where some of the tension is, yep, right now, yep, with a president who is implying and then sometimes saying outright that this is a criminal population.
Absolutely. So the data will show over and over again that immigrants, documented or not, are much less likely to commit crimes than the native-born population. But the problem here is that, and the challenge is that the president is, and in his State of the Union, he did this. When he talked about immigration, you know, for 8 minutes, 80% of it was about MS-13. So he's leading the American public to conflate MS-13 with immigrants. So that's why I think that for law enforcement in particular to be saying, you know what, if we want to eradicate MS-13 from our community, we have to understand, number one, who they're preying upon. They're preying upon immigrants. Therefore, we need to be working with immigrants who are here documented or not so that they are reporting crimes. Because the immigrant community, number one, does not want MS-13 as their neighborhood and as their neighbors and preying upon them. And number two, are much less likely to be committing crimes than native-born Americans. So I think we have to make this case in a way that, again, brings it home to somebody's individual life. I think talking about, you know, rates of crime at a national level, it doesn't bring it home to that person who's saying, you know what, if I'm driving down the street, should I be afraid? And I think we have to make the case to folks that, no, you shouldn't be afraid, because the immigrant community doesn't want MS-13 in their neighborhood either. So let's work together to make sure that these awful gangsters are removed from society and our country if they're here, if they're not citizens.
But however it operates as policy or potential policy, it's certainly powerful rhetoric, and it puts you on your heels, doesn't it? Because you have to take a moment to explain, oh, just what tiny portion of the overall community MS-13 is, to acknowledge that they really are a problem, to acknowledge that they really are a threat and they are here, while trying to make the far more subtle case that you also want them out.
Absolutely. I mean, there are, you know, the way I've always put this is that there are 100 ways to say no to immigration. There's like 2 ways to say yes. And, you know, in terms of like the world of kind of soundbite education, you know, we need a lot of bites of sound in order to get our point across. But that's also why I think that, you know, the experiences that people are having in their communities of living next to, becoming friends with the immigrant and refugee community is so important. And, you know, it's hard work. It's difficult work. But I think those experiences wedded with smart, compassionate civic leadership, you know, helps us get there.
Anybody who's been listening to this debate knows that you has an idea where you come down in this current national conversation over immigration. How do you remain optimistic in the face of the election of a president who made a lot of hay and garnered a lot of support by being pretty tough on the idea of not only illegal immigration, but legal immigration as well? How do you stay optimistic in the face of public sentiment that's made its way to the halls of Capitol Hill that may or may not represent the opinions of the public at large, but the Congress is where it's at right now?
Yeah. I think there are 2 reasons that I remain optimistic. Number one is the immigrant community. You know, when most of us ask for a raise or for a day off or, you know, something, you know, we get a little bit of a lump in our stomach, right? The immigrant community, whether they're dreamers or folks who have been here for, you know, have green cards, they're advocating for themselves. They're telling the American public and policymakers their story and asking for help. And that takes a incredible amount of courage, and an amount of courage that I have no idea. I can't even fathom, and it inspires me every day. And I was in Spokane, Washington earlier this week and meeting with dreamers at Whitworth University. It's a Christian liberal arts college in Spokane. And these young people from around the world who had come to Spokane of all places, they were making their case to the administration, to the public, of why they wanted to contribute to the U.S. society as full-fledged U.S. citizens. And that was just inspirational. The other reason that I just have to be optimistic is that, you know, regardless of what happens with the legislative debate, regardless of what happens with this administration, I think more Americans than ever have come to realize that their kid's best friend is undocumented, the family one pew over at church is undocumented, the family down the street are refugees, and they've come to know and love those families and those individuals. And, you know, regardless of what happens to legislation, those millions of Americans will never forget that. So that's another reason I think that it's important to be optimistic.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Ours is a nonprofit membership organization, and we're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. Visit us at worldaffairs.org. This program featured Ali Noorani, Executive Director of the National Immigration Reform, and he was in conversation with my co-host, Ray Suarez. This broadcast is made possible each week by the generous support of Chevron and the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation. Our technical supervisor is Monte Carlos. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.